You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.
Today on our show, I'm talking with Audrey Chan. She's talking to me from Los Angeles. Audrey, thanks for being with me today.
Thanks for having me on your show.
Audrey, let's talk about what you're working on now. I know you're doing a public art commission. Can you tell me a little bit about, I think maybe we should just say how that commission came to be, how you applied for it or what it was, and then let's talk about what it is, the commission itself, if that's what you're working on now.
Sure, yeah. Like with all public art, most projects are several years in the making. And so Metro Art, which is the public art division of the Metro Transit System in Los Angeles, they commission contemporary artists to create works for stations, for bus posters, et cetera. And so they put out a call in 2014 for artists to apply to be on a pre-selected list. And so I did that back in the day. And in 2015, I was contacted and told that I was a finalist for an upcoming subway station at First and Central in downtown in the Little Tokyo neighborhood for a rather large public artwork that would be comprised of 14 panel assemblies that would be on either side of a subway train platform. And so part of the process is that they really wanted the artwork to respond to the local community. And in this case, the local community is the historic Little Tokyo neighborhood and the Arts District, which are neighboring each other in downtown. And so I was thinking a lot about the context of that site, and it's incredibly rich culturally, and it's this really interesting representation of like a moment in American history with a lot of contradictions. And I was also thinking about the context of government commissioned civic art in the U.S. in general. And so my piece is called Willpower Allegory, and it intentionally plays with that acronym of WPA that you might associate with like the Works Progress Administration.
That SPR. Wonderful time as I think of WPA, it's that wonderful time when the government was supporting the work of now artists that are enormously important.
Exactly. And I had grown up with a kind of idealized impression of that program as well. But then thinking about it more, like I had grown up in Oak Park, Illinois, which is a suburb of Chicago. And in our local post office, there were still like remaining WPA Federal Art Project murals there. Like I think post offices and schools were really important sites where these murals took place. And it made me remember like that those murals kind of presented a very idealized vision of what America was and Americana. And I think we take it for granted that a lot of the figures that are centralized in those images are Caucasian. And I was also in my junior high, there were WPA murals as well. But I was thinking about how that history and that New Deal program almost like overlapped in time with the Executive Order 9066 in 1942 that FDR signed to order the internment of Japanese Americans during World War II. And I was like, how can these two histories coexist, even like within one administration? And I wanted the piece in a way to be like a revision of the kinds of images that we see in presentations of like capital A America. So that's
there's a number of interesting things there. Because it's in you said Little Tokyo, right? Is that what it's called, the area? So there's also that's obviously kind of reflective of the area itself, right? Speaking to people coming in that area.
Right.
So that's very interesting. And tell me a little bit more about how that will what kind of imagery will be used, or how will viewers experience that? I mean, and how much space is it taking up, et cetera?
So I'm thinking, even though it's 14 separate panel assemblies, I'm thinking of it as a piece to be experienced in the round as one composition. And so I'm imagining it as a kind of like dreamscape of little Tokyo that allows like narratives from the past, present, and a kind of like speculative future to be mingling together. And so a lot of the imagery is based in like figurative, allegorical imagery. Because I worked at the Getty Museum for about 7 years. And so during that time, I really absorbed a kind of European and Greco-Roman allegorical system that appeared in, like, you know, paintings by Rubens and Rembrandt and whatnot, and like learned how to internalize and tell those stories and be able to like read iconography. And so I've been fascinated by this idea of iconography and kind of like shared symbols that can be in a way read or interpreted like text. And I was thinking of this piece as being very time-based, like it could unfold over the decades. It's going to be a permanent installation, like beyond my lifetime probably. And I wanted to put new images in there. So it's not just that we keep relying on the same like Western images as our shared narrative images over time, but that I could put in hyper-specific cultural images that relate to the immigrant experience in LA in the US, the indigenous experience of the descendants of slaves, and that those can be the visual narratives that we can unpack together, whether it's by people who pass through the station every day and want to understand who is appearing in the artwork, or people who just pass through once and stumble into this narrative that they're suddenly immersed in. So, for example, like one of the figures in the piece will be Biddy Mason. She was the first African-American female property owner in LA, and she actually owned the parcel of land that is Little Tokyo today. And she was actually a freed slave. So she was brought to California as a slave, as I believe a teenage girl. And so you have stories like that. You have stories like Toyo Miyatake, who is a portrait photographer based in Little Tokyo, who made some of the most iconic images inside Manzanar internment camp because he like smuggled in a camera lens. And so he represented the experience of his fellow internees. And so like people like that will figure prominently in the piece.
And how are you portraying them? So explain how the narrative reads, if you can, a little bit. So we see someone like this, this man who is a photographer and documented this, this terrible situation. Is his biography there, or how do people know who he is and what he has done, or do they?
So each of the images that's going into the piece, in a way I'm compiling like research files on each of them, and it's impractical for me to fill the work with explanatory text. And so maybe it's from my background in like museum education or whatnot, but I'm actually compiling a kind of glossary that will accompany the piece that can be accessible online later. So once the artwork's finished, my next step will be working on that resource. And so people could experience the piece just like on a purely visual level, but I wanted that information to be accessible later on. But in a way, I'm isolating the figures and creating a kind of image bank that I'm drawing from. And so it's all like line drawings in flat color as the technical like working process that I'm using. But then I'm assembling them and putting them in new vignettes that I'm imagining. So in my scene, like Biddy Mason could very well be interacting with Toyo Miyatake, even though they never interacted in real life. So on that level, it's a kind of like historical fantasy that I'm constructing.
That's interesting. So is the narrative of that, are you still working on that historical fantasy, the way all these characters might interact, or is that something that you've laid out already?
It's very nonlinear, the process that I'm using. So I'm building the piece in Adobe Illustrator, and it allows a lot of flexibility in terms of being able to move images around, layering them, scaling them tiny or large. And so every day when I compose new images, I arrange them almost like paper dolls. And the piece could keep being in flux for the rest of the year as I'm working on it. So it's very much a work in progress right now.
Well, that's exciting. So how long will this take? It sounds like a huge project, right? How long will the whole narrative be in terms of just the square footage of what you're working with?
So in total, it's about 2,300 square feet. So this is the biggest and maybe the biggest artwork I could ever possibly work on. What's crazy is that I'm very much like projecting my piece like into that space in my mind right now, because I'm building it all like on my computer, essentially. But it's huge. And so I started the artwork back in 2015 when I first proposed it, but it was confirmed that I got the commission last summer, and so I'm working on it until January of 2018. So it's really incredible to be able to like have that much time to devote to a piece. And I want it to make it as complex as it needs to be.
It is exciting to have that time. And concurrently while you're doing that, you're still teaching, is that correct?
I was teaching in the spring semester at CalArts in the School of Art. And so that's wrapped up. But that was a great experience to be back at my alma mater teaching a seminar and workshop.
And so how will it work after this? Are you going back to teaching in the fall, or do you have all this time to keep working on their project? Because it seems demanding to do it all by January even.
Yeah, I'm taking it one day at a time right now. I'm not quite sure what my 2018 would be. I would love to teach again. I taught a seminar called The Art of the Dead that was about funerary art and mourning from like antiquity to present day, and then a class on ethics and advocacy in art. So teaching is definitely like in my lifeblood. Both my parents are currently retired college professors. But I would love to do more public art projects. I'd love to just keep painting and drawing.
So how does that fit in with your whole practice? I mean, just to step back a little bit, you've worked in a lot of mediums and collaboratively, in almost all mediums that I can think of. Public art, of course, is another whole other world, and you're communicating with a different kind of audience and everything. So, I mean, in a way, you just answered my question, but in terms of how it's fitting into your practice and the fact that you've had gallery exhibitions in different places, this is now no longer about kind of gallery exhibitions. It's a public permanent exhibition. Would you want to keep doing this only, or is this a portion of your practice? I guess I'm trying to get more into what you mean at the end there by what you just said about wanting to do more of public art. Would that mean less of other kinds of art, or not being an exhibiting artist the same way? Or,
you know, it's funny. I've never been able to really boil down my art practice into a single all-encompassing a project. I'm very project driven, and so if the next project or a collaborative performance like that would totally make sense in my grand scheme of things. And so I never think of the projects as like trade-offs between one and another. Like, for example, like this public art project is allowing me to pull from my experience, like as like studying political science undergrad and doing like community activism and having like these one-on-one conversations with community stakeholders. Like that is so exciting to me, and not something I was able to do in other projects that were more like centered in a kind of like gallery or art world context. And so I'm very flexible in terms of how I think of my work. For me, all the projects are linked by an ethos of thinking about the politics of representation and identity and how we imagine an image of America and constantly allowing that to exist in its full complexity. And
That's so timely, right? I mean, isn't that still what we're examining? I mean, Manzanita, you know, wasn't that long ago. And, you know, the idea even of the travel ban and what's happening now seems kind of like a version of that kind of drive that created the internment camps for Japanese Americans.
Oh, yeah. And I've been so inspired by the way the Japanese American community has been so incredibly vocal and supportive of the Muslim community, starting with 9/11. I mean, the Japanese American community, from their own lived experience in the U.S., made that connection right away. It wasn't just that Donald Trump connected the dots for them. So I've been going to rallies in the neighborhood, and just the activism that exists in the JA community and other solidarity-based movements in LA has been a huge touchstone for my work, and I'm so lucky to be able to participate on a visual level.
That is exciting. Well, I look forward to seeing this when it's done. And before we go, I want to ask you what you're reading at the moment. Is there any particular book or books you're in the middle of or starting or have read that you'd like to share?
Yeah, there's a book by Jeff Chang that I read maybe 2 years ago called Who We Be, The Colorization of America. And he wrote this very much in the context of like how do we talk about race and identity during the Obama era? And he also wrote a book called We Gonna Be All Right that came out like right before the election time that speaks more to our current moment. And so he is an amazing cultural theorist that I look to constantly. And he weaves in contemporary art into the narrative of like multiculturalism and the post-multiculturalism context that I really appreciate, because he said that artists are where we can see the future, and artists are the ones who like present possibilities that we may not be able to see right now. And then I've also been exploring the archives of Ghidra newspaper, and they were published out of LA by a group of Asian American activists during the late 60s and the 70s, like during the height of the Vietnam era.
So this is an independent newspaper? Is that what it is?
It's an independent newspaper, entirely volunteer run, and it was known as the newspaper of the Asian American movement. And I didn't grow up learning that history. And so now to be able to think about the 70s through that lens is so eye-opening for me. And their newspaper is archived. Now the whole run is available on a website called densho.org, densho.org. And it's a really like boots on the ground look at what it means to have a pan-Asian solidarity movement that was very much inspired by the Black Power movement, by the Chicano movement, and as part of a larger third wave, third world liberation movement. And so they were the ones who demanded the ethnic studies departments be created at universities, that they give voice to the experience of Asian American GIs fighting in Vietnam against people who looked a lot like them, and what it means to be in solidarity with other groups. There's this text called The Emergence of Yellow Power in America by a writer named Amy Uematsu that I keep going back to. And she wrote it as one of the first texts for the new Asian American Studies program at UCLA. And I've since gotten to know her better. She's still like an amazing sansei, third generation JA poet based in LA. And so like through the Metro Project and just through my own research, I feel like I've been so lucky to connect with these people who are still really active in the city and to connect my work with theirs.
Audrey, I wish you great success and with the rest of this project and finishing it. That's really thrilling to hear about. And I want to thank you for talking with me today. It's been great talking to you about your work and this current project.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure.
You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.